Podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology with an MFT evening format. Priority deadline to apply for September classes is July 8th. GSEP.pepperdine.edu.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Still waiting on the Supreme Court to make a decision on whether to keep or pull that citizenship question on the 2020 census. While we stand by, we'll hear why, in the entire nation, L.A. is considered the most challenging area to get an accurate count. Plus, for the first time in decades, there are baby golden eagles in the Santa Monica Mountains. That and a lot more coming up when Take Two kicks off in just a few. Keep your ears here.
Podcasts supported by Spectrum News One. Host Alex Cohen provides a deeper look at the issues affecting Southern Californians and their communities on Inside the Issues, weeknights at 8 on Spectrum News One on Channel One, exclusively on Spectrum.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm A. Martinez. Thanks, as always, for joining us. Coming up later in today's show, we're going to find out more about the pair of baby eagle chicks that were discovered in the Santa Monica Mountains. Golden eagles haven't been seen in the area for 30 years, so we're wondering why they're back. I'm really excited about that one. We're also going to check in on a new law set for July 1st that would mandate police body cam footage be released a lot more quickly. But first, a possible worker walkout. Earlier this week, grocery store workers at Vons, Ralph's, and Albertsons voted to give their union leaders the authority to strike. Now, this doesn't mean a strike is imminent or will even happen, but it does give officials the leverage to call for a walkout at any time. And considering the last big supermarket strike in LA 16 years ago was hugely disruptive for the workers, the stores, and their customers, we thought we'd check in on what's going on. And for that, we got KPCC business reporter David Wagner, who's been following all the developments. David, welcome back.
Hi, A.
All right, so what's behind today's strike authorization vote?
Well, all across Southern California right now, there are thousands of grocery store workers who've been working under an expired contract since March. And right now, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union has been trying to hammer out a new deal at the bargaining table with these corporate chains. Those negotiations haven't been making any progress lately. The union says the companies are offering raises of less than 1%, and they say that that puts a lot of workers in LA at just barely above the minimum wage, and it just isn't keeping up with the rising cost of living here. So this vote doesn't put people out on the picket line yet, but union leaders are hoping that it puts pressure on these companies to come back with a better offer.
How many markets and employees are we talking about here?
This covers hundreds of stores across Southern California, and we're talking about 46,000 union workers at stores like Albertsons, Vons, Pavilions, and Ralph's. You know, these are chains that have a huge presence here. They're still often, you know, the most convenient and accessible stores in a lot of neighborhoods.
I remember the last grocery strike here. That was 2003. That lasted a long time. More than $1 billion in sales were lost. Employees struggled to pay the bills. Could that happen again? I mean, what might be different this time around?
Yeah, I mean, that was a historic strike for this industry. It lasted more than 4 months. And I think that both sides really want to avoid a repeat of something like that. You know, back then, the strike really pushed shoppers to other stores. It pushed them to Costco, smaller ethnic markets.
Yeah.
Today, shoppers have even more options. You know, stores like Trader Joe's and Whole Foods have expanded. Other stores like Walmart have bigger grocery sections than they used to. So these unionized chains, we've seen them lose ground in the overall grocery market. So, you know, it's unclear if a strike today would have quite the same impact it did back in 2003.
All right, so what is next? When do union leaders meet again?
Both sides are back at the bargaining table on July 10th, and representatives for Ralph's and Albertsons, which also owns Vons and Pavilions, have told me that, you know, this vote, this strike authorization vote, doesn't change anything for them. Their stores are still open for business. They say they're still trying to negotiate this new contract. Next week, we're going to get a vote from other unions that have workers in grocery stores, like delivery people, janitors. They're going to hold their own vote on whether to sanction a strike. So, you know, this could be resolved before customers ever see workers taking any action, but we'll just have to wait and see how these negotiations move forward.
All right, that's KPCC's David Wagner on the vote by grocery store workers today to authorize a strike. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, now to a new law that would require California law enforcement to release its officers' body cam footage more quickly, within 45 days of a critical incident. Currently, this footage isn't always available to the public, but that'll change July 1st. Assemblymember Phil Ting wrote the legislation. He joins us now. Welcome back to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
Now, briefly, Assemblymember, what does the law, AB 748, mandate?
What it mandates is that after the law enforcement agency gets a request for public information, they have 45 days to release the body camera footage for critical incidents such as a police shooting or a use of force shooting. And if they can't do it within the 45 days, they can ask for a 30-day extension, but they have to tell us why. And they have to tell us if it's under investigation, if there's certain sensitive information. Right now, much of the sensitive footage is automatically being denied to the public, and there's no reason given.
We mentioned a critical incident, that term. What does that mean exactly?
Roughly, it means incidents where there's use of force, incidents where there's been police shootings. If you think about many of the high-profile incidents that have occurred in the news, that's roughly what it covers.
Why is this important? Why do you think this is needed?
Well, it's so important because body cameras were purchased for agencies to really build trust between communities and law enforcement. And unfortunately, that trust has really been eroded over the last couple of years. And what we hope is by being able to get access to that footage, we can rebuild that trust between agencies and communities.
And does AB 748 standardize policy regarding body cam recordings in the state?
Absolutely. You know, most cities did not have any policy, and a few cities did, but they were all inconsistent. So if you're in L.A., and depending on whether you got stopped by LAPD or by the L.A. County Sheriff, they have two different body camera footage policies. In fact, what we did is we modeled it after the L.A. City policy, and we really hope to have a standard policy now statewide, which everybody should follow.
Talking to California Assemblymember Phil Ting. Now, in April of 2018, the L.A. Police Commission adopted a similar policy to your law. What other law enforcement agencies have done the same, and who is lacking in adopting policies?
You know, most agencies haven't adopted policies. That was part of the frustration, is that the public would ask for information, and then you had the head of the agency just automatically deny it if they didn't feel like releasing it. What we want to make sure is, again, that the public gets access to this information, but that law enforcement has the ability to withhold it if there's adequate reasons, such as an investigation, such as there's, you know, sensitive information, there's certain privacy issues there. We thought it was really important to have this consistent statewide law. It's the first one of its kind in the state, and we think it's really going to change how the hopefully will change how the public really feels about law enforcement. Because again, they're going to see this footage, they'll see how tough a job it is every single day. But on the other hand, they're also going to get access to information that they've been requesting for a while.
Now, when it comes to withholding the footage, though, say a police agency wants to withhold it for a while for whatever reason, what is in place with 748 that would maybe at least have some oversight on what they decide to show and what they don't?
Well, right now, the biggest oversight is, frankly, the public as well as the media. They've been holding these agencies really feet to the fire. And what this would do is really allow the public, when they're requesting this information, to get a legitimate reason why it's being withheld. Right now, if you ask for the information today, they could just say, no, we're denying your request without any excuse, any reasoning. And it leaves family members in the dark. You know, we had a family from San Jose where unfortunately there was a police officer shooting. The wife was in tears talking about how important it was to get access to this footage because as part of the grieving process, it's really kind of getting closure over the incident versus all these different what ifs, what happened. That was really what body cameras were meant to sort of answer.
So say going forward, Assemblymember, if I wanted some body cam footage and a police agency said no and they're giving a reason, does it end there? Could I still appeal or is that where the process ends for me?
You know, that's what you could do is you could keep requesting.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, the only reason they can permanently withhold it is that it's under investigation. Once that investigation ends, they would have to release it. So let's say the reason is, hey, we're under investigation, you know, follow up in 2 months, and then you could follow up and keep following up with them. But at some point, that investigation would have to come to an end, and they would have to release that.
In the past, what traditionally has been the process for someone to want to get the body cam footage or the process that they would have to go through to get it?
You know, everybody's been a little bit different. I can just tell you that most cities just treat it differently. You had to go to different places to go get it. But the most common way is you send a letter, request for information, and oftentimes it would get released, but for many times, for the most sensitive cases, many times it wouldn't. So I think that's the biggest challenge. It felt like the body camera footage would get released during the times where the public really didn't care about the footage, and when the public did care about the footage, it wasn't getting released. So I think that's really what our law is trying to help with.
Now, to be clear, what purposes is police body cam footage typically used for?
Well, the purpose, again, is to do two things. It's to, one, help with investigations, so it's supposed to be on at all times, and then, two, it's really supposed to provide transparency and really, let the public see sort of what the officer has to go through. And so, given that, it doesn't really help the public understand what the officer has to go through if they can't get access to the footage. Now, we do know that the footage is being used for investigations, and we think that part is great. But again, that second piece in terms of building the trust and having the transparency hasn't always worked out.
Now, one more thing, Assemblymember. I understand you're now working on companion legislation having to do with facial recognition software in body cameras. What can you tell us about AB 1275?
So AB 1275 bans the use of facial recognition software in body cameras. It's over in the Senate right now. And we think this is very smart. You know, we even have one of the major manufacturers of body cameras saying that they don't believe facial recognition software should be used on body cameras. We had Microsoft unwilling to sell their facial recognition software to a law enforcement agency in California that wasn't disclosed. And the main reason why is because it's not completely accurate yet. It's not ready to be used. So rather than have agencies start to deploy faulty software, we really thought it was just important just to ban it from body cameras because, again, body cameras are on all the time and they're roving around in our communities. So if you have facial recognition software, it'd be similar to having 24/7 surveillance on the street without any kind of public process. If a city was going to put 1,000 cameras on its city street for safety reasons, there would be a significant amount of public process. There would be no public process if you put that software on body cameras and it just got deployed. So we think it's very concerning. We want to make sure that software really isn't being utilized with body cameras. We don't think it's a very smart thing right now.
That's California Assemblymember Phil Ting. Thank you very much.
Thank you, A.
When L.A. County Sheriff Alex Villanueva released video last week of two deputies fatally shooting 24-year-old Ryan Twyman in the parking lot of a South L.A. apartment complex, the images came from security cameras. Now, that might have raised a question for some folks. Why didn't the Sheriff's Department release video from the deputies' body cameras? Well, the answer is simple. The L.A. Sheriff's Department remains the largest law enforcement agency in the country that does not put cameras on its cops, despite demands from the public and police watchdogs to do it. That's expected to change, though, and for a closer look at how and when, we turn to KPCC's Frank Stoltz. Hello, Frank.
Hey.
All right, so why doesn't the Sheriff's Department have body cameras?
Well, part of the answer lies in the tumultuous exit of former Sheriff Lee Baca, who abruptly resigned in 2014 amid a federal investigation of jail brutality by his deputies. He and his undersheriff, of course, were later indicted. That year, the sheriff and the LAPD both tested body-worn cameras on a few officers. The LAPD, under pressure from the mayor and the civilian police commission that oversees that department, within 3 years equipped 7,000 officers with cameras. The sheriff's department, meantime, with its independently elected sheriff, did not face such political pressure. It also was struggling with this leadership crisis that saw three different sheriffs in 1 year. Enter then Sheriff Jim McDonnell, who was elected at the end of 2014. He said there were other priorities at the department when he came on board, like ending jail brutality. And when he finally asked the Board of Supervisors for money for a body-worn camera program in 2016, he asked for a lot of money. Here's Sheriff's Commander Chris Marks, who has been the department's point man on cameras through all of this.
the previous implementation plan under Sheriff McDonald called for an additional 239 people at a cost of $55 million annually. And, you know, it stopped there. There was no movement by the board to fund the program at that cost.
McDonald argued at the time he needed all those people to view videos, respond to public records requests, maintain the system, etc. But the board was not prepared to give him that much money.
All right, so exit McDonald after being ousted by Alex Villanueva in last November's election. Where does the new sheriff stand on body cameras?
Well, the new sheriff had promised a body cam program by now, by summertime. He may have been a bit optimistic on that. But he did come up with a cheaper program, mainly by hiring about 30 new employees instead of more than 230. And there has been movement that actually started last year. Supervisors hired International Chiefs of Police Association to study how to do it cheaper, best practices, etc. This week, the Board of Supervisors set aside another $10 million in an account for body cams. And next month, the CEO will formally ask for about $32 million in startup costs to be handed to the sheriff next month.
Okay, so the ball is rolling, but when will those body cameras be on the deputies?
Well, the department still needs to go through the request for a proposal process, hire a company. Hard to imagine they won't hire Axon, the taser company that does body cams now. LAPD hires them. Depending on how long all that takes, the sheriff's department could have cameras as early as the end of summer. That's probably too optimistic, as the sheriff tends to be. More likely the beginning of next year. They're going to start with five stations, the busy Century, Lancaster, Lakewood stations, but also less busy West Hollywood and City of Industry stations. But, as you know very well, you need to keep people happy, and the people the sheriff needs to keep happy are the Board of Supervisors who provide him funding. So instead of putting them at all busy stations where the most shootings happen, for example, you end up with one at West Hollywood, which is, you know, doesn't have a lot of shootings. All 23 stations, by the way, plus the Parks Bureau, community colleges, deputies at county buildings, projected to happen within 2 years. And that'll be about 5,200 cops, street deputies, sergeants, and lieutenants.
And the sheriffs and the Board of Supes haven't been pals much lately.
Well, you know, and that's true. On this one, you know, there was a little bit of infighting, but they seem to come to an agreement.
All right. Now, okay, so what will the policy in terms of when deputies would have to turn on their body cameras be, and when would the public be able to see any videos?
Yeah, well, they're going to follow more or less the LAPD policy on when deputies are supposed to turn on cameras. Here's again Commander Marks.
Anytime that we're taking an enforcement type of action or an investigative type of action, that the camera should be turned on prior to, if possible, and remain on for the entire incident. They also recognize that there's times where deputy sheriffs need discretion in being able to temporarily turn the camera off.
And those are, for instance, if there's a child involved or domestic violence involved where somebody does not want to be filmed, and filming would impede the investigation. As for when the public would see the videos, we now have, as you just heard, this new state law. So they'll release high-profile shootings, other incidents within 45 days.
45 days. Now, one crucial question is, will deputies who use deadly force be allowed to see the video before they tell investigators their version of what happened?
Yeah, and this is important because we know the law allows police officers and sheriff's deputies to use deadly force based on their reasonable perception at the time of the shooting.
Yeah.
Many watchdogs say if you view a video, that changes your story about what you were perceiving in that moment. They've generally lost that argument. Most police departments, police unions are arguing that police need to see the video before they give their reason for shooting someone because it helps them refresh their memory. Commander Mark says the sheriff's department will probably follow the same policy. They're facing a situation where deputies could stop giving voluntary statements after a shooting if they're not allowed to see the video.
Homicide Bureau investigators. We don't want to create a policy that hampers that investigation. Whereas if a deputy is not allowed to watch the video, they're suddenly not providing us voluntary statements anymore. And then we have to move through the investigative process without statements from the involved deputies.
To be clear, right now at the Sheriff's Department, deputies who use deadly force voluntarily give a statement about what happened to investigators. And essentially, the union has and there may have not have been an outright threat, mm-hmm. but clearly the department is worried that they will stop giving those voluntary statements if they're not allowed to see the video first. So it's very likely policies aren't written and signed off on yet, but that the officers will, the deputies will be able to see the video before they give their version of the shooting.
That's KPCC's Frank Stoltz. Frank, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Still waiting on the Supreme Court to make a decision on whether to keep or pull that citizenship question on the 2020 census. While we stand by, we'll hear why in the entire nation, Los Angeles is considered the most challenging area to get an accurate count. And if you had to guess, what LA neighborhood do you think tops the list of toughest to count? The answer is next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth. An online hybrid tailored for working professionals with attendance only twice per term in West LA. Attend an information session to learn more. Classes start September. Apply by July 8th for a $1,000 scholarship at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Now, all week, we've been waiting on the Supreme Court to decide whether to allow a question about one's citizenship status on the next census form. It looks like the decision will come down tomorrow, if it comes down at all. The Supreme Court wraps up its sessions this week. But decision or no decision, we wanted to take the next few minutes to talk about the 2020 census and why it's important. Because before the citizenship question was even a thing, the census had its challenges, especially right here in LA. Now, we've said it before, we'll say it again, LA County historically has been one of the hardest areas in the whole United States to count, and that's according to data from the census itself. Now, this is due to a variety of factors, the sheer size of the city and area being one big one. So, just to cut to the chase, there is a lot at stake here if Angelenos are not fully or even mostly accounted for, which is why participation is so important. Now, to tackle all these issues, I've got two guests. KPCC data editor Dana Emma here is in studio. Hello.
Hello.
Arturo Vargas joins us from Marketplace Studios downtown. He's chief executive officer of Naleo Education Fund, a nonprofit that aims to engage Latinos in civic life. Arturo, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you.
All right, Dana, you've done a ton of research on this. Paint a picture for us. Where are some of the hardest to count communities in LA, and broadly speaking, why?
The hardest to count census tract in LA County is actually in Koreatown. And one of the reasons for that is because of the high population of foreign-born. The per capita income and median household income are very low. There are a lot of people living there. So there are a lot of factors that contribute to what's known as the hard-to-count index at work in this one census tract.
Now, Arturo, many of LA's challenges here come down to size, as I mentioned, but it's also diversity. Tell us about the hurdles this presents, language, of course, being one of the top on the list.
Fortunately, the Census Bureau has enough experience about the need to count Latinos that it has developed a bilingual form in English and Spanish that it will mail out to census tracts. But there is a myriad of languages in Los Angeles County. Everyone else will have to rely on assistant guides, not an actual form in their language. Now, the fact it's a digital census does give an advantage here because the Census Bureau is able to put on its website more forms in different languages, but nonetheless, it is still a hurdle for people to understand this concept of enumeration in the United States, especially for people who are fairly new and don't recall or weren't here for the 2010 census.
Sorry about the 2020 census with Arturo Vargas. He's chief executive officer of Naleo Educational Fund and also KPCC data editor Dana Emma here. All right, now another aspect that we do not talk about as much is the housing situation for many people living here. Lots of apartments, generally overpopulated living spaces, not to mention the homeless. Dana, break down the numbers for us on that.
So in LA County, we have nearly 3.3 occupied housing units here that are rented, which is the second highest rate in California behind San Francisco. In terms of crowded households, almost 5% of LA County's occupied housing units average more than 1.5 people per room. We trail only one other county, which is Monterey. Mm. And we also have, with that high concentration of renters, LA County has a high volume, obviously, of apartment buildings. So statewide, we're talking about, 29% of buildings being apartment buildings. In LA County, we're talking 40%.
Wow, big difference. Arturo, as someone who's out there trying to reach people and talk about why participating in the census is so important, what do these numbers mean to you on a ground level?
It means we have some incredible challenges here in Los Angeles. You know, one of the unknown facts about how people are undercounted is not that they choose not to participate in the census, but it comes down to the fact that the person filling out the form from a particular housing unit did not include everybody on the form. That's especially true of why children are left off. So we need to do an incredible education job for the individuals filling out the census forms for these housing units to remind them everybody who lives there needs to be included.
Now, Arturo, you mentioned earlier that it's the first year that the census is going digital, and there are some issues, trust issues with that as well. What could that mean for participation rates?
The fact that the Bureau will have the census form available online means it'll be easier for the Bureau to provide different languages. But if folks believe that this is an online-only census, they may be discouraged from participating if they don't have access to hardware or software or broadband in order to participate online. So part of our campaign will be to ensure that those who want to respond online know how to have access to it. And if you do not want to respond online, remember, you will get a paper form and still be able to fill it out in paper.
Dana, let's get into what's changed in the last 10 years. Less newspaper readership, more social media engagement, for example. What hurdles does this potentially put up for trying to get people to get the message out there that people need to participate in this population count?
So some of the researchers and some of the community activists that I've talked to think that we need to think of reaching people in this new universe, in this new world, in a different way. That we have to think of this census as civic engagement and with the same sort of activism and the same sort of grassroots social movement that we have around something like voting. You get a sticker when you go to vote.
Yeah.
You're able to show everybody that I've done my civic duty. Maybe we should start doing that with census too. One of the other things that I think that the Census Bureau has to take into consideration 10 years later is the fact that there is a historic level of mistrust in government right now that perhaps wasn't there 10 years ago. We've also got people being bombarded with messages and information and misinformation. It's also an election year. We've got people's attention being competed for left and right.
And it's stretched thin everywhere.
It's very, very stretched thin.
We're talking 2020 census with Arturo Vargas of Naleo and KPCC data editor Dana Ama here. All right, let's turn now to what's at stake, because the more accurate the state's census count is, the more equitable is its share of funds. So, Arturo, what's on the table for Los Angeles?
There's only two things at stake here, power and money, and it's all based on who gets counted or not. We know that L.A. County is at risk of losing a congressional seat either to another state altogether or perhaps to the Inland Empire because of the distribution of population that has occurred over the past 10 years. If we want to make sure that we have our fair share of congressional representation here in LA County, we need to make sure everybody gets counted. Lack of being counted in the census means your community gets less than your fair share of political representation. And then we have money. $800 billion a year are allocated from the federal government to the states and to the counties using census data in the formulas to determine how much money goes where.
So, Dana, what specific programs could be affected with an undercount?
We're talking Section 8 housing vouchers. We're talking Head Start programs, special education funding grants. You name it, it's probably touched in some way by census data. One thing I would like to add is that just aside from the funding portion of it, we need to know how many people live in our country. The integrity of just the data itself is extremely important.
Arturo, so how do you get through to people? I mean, you're launching a big campaign to get the word out. Tell us about that.
So we've been doing a series of messaging research projects to try to determine what are the messages and messengers that are most suited to encourage people to fill out their census forms. And we've learned that if you explain to the public how your community benefits from a accurate and full count, people get it. People understand that if you count all the children, then you know where the schools should be built and how much funding should go to education. But who they hear it from is also just as important. We don't need to have athletes and celebrities necessarily promoting the census. We need to have individuals that the hardest to count populations trust. They trust their children's teacher. They trust their healthcare provider. They trust their priest or their pastor. These are the kind of individuals in local communities that we're working out to engage and to prepare so that they could be census messengers come 2020.
Now, Arturo, there's a lot of campaign messages that have worked for you in terms of getting people to connect the dots on why the census matters. What has not worked? And give us a sense of what really has worked really well.
The community benefit that I talked about was the most compelling. Less compelling was to tell people it was required by law or it was your civic duty. Least compelling was that this was your way to stand up to the Trump administration.
Least compelling?
People didn't believe it, but they understood the community benefit.
Now, just to circle back to this citizenship question that we could hear more about tomorrow, Arturo, if the court rules that it can be added to the 2020 census form, how much harder does an already difficult job get for you as you try to make sure that every Angeleno gets counted?
Our work is going to be exponentially more difficult because we now will have a federal government doing the census that is also telling our community it's going to cancel DACA. It's going to cancel temporary protected status. It's going to build a wall. And by the way, are you a citizen? We have to convince now all Angelenos that even though this federal government is asking, are you a citizen, yes or no, and we know the motivations have nothing to do with getting accurate data on the U.S. population, we'll have to convince folks that any perceived risk of being counted is outweighed by the harm that comes to our communities by not having everybody counted in the census.
That's Arturo Vargas of Naleo and KPCC data editor Dana Emma here about the 2020 census and why it's important that everyone in Los Angeles County and the state get counted. Arturo, Dana, thanks a lot.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
All right, I got a Netflix, Amazon, and Hulu subscription. Now, for years, that's all I've needed. I get everything there. Sitcoms, rom-coms, docs, action, stand-up, cartoons, all that has always been there on those three sites. Until now. Entertainment companies are creating their own services, pulling content from those other places, and then putting it exclusively on their sites. Coming up, find out which streaming services are streamlining their stuff. That's next when Take Two continues.
Podcasts supported by Spectrum News One, where talk meets action, where politicians meet constituents, where issues meet understanding. Join host Alex Cohen for Inside the Issues on Spectrum News One, a nightly political show that takes you inside the issues affecting you, your family, and your community. Inside the Issues, weeknights at 8 on Spectrum News One on Channel One, exclusively on Spectrum.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. Emmy Martinez. Warner Brothers has a new CEO. She's the first woman to helm the studio in its almost 100-year history. Plus, how Netflix is upending the business, the stand-up comedy special. Let's go on the lot.
Hey, shut up! God, I wish you'd
stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter, and she's our guide every Wednesday. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello, A.
All right, let's kick things off with news about Ann Sarnoff, Warner Brothers' first female CEO. She's stepping into the role following some drama. So remind us what happened with the studio's predecessor, Kevin Sugihara.
In March, my colleagues at The Hollywood Reporter published a piece that depicted Kevin Sugihara allegedly trying to get acting roles for a woman with whom he was having an affair. Sugihara says he had no direct role in the hiring of the actress, but nevertheless, within a week, Sugihara stepped down. from his role at the studio.
Now, you spoke with Sarnoff following the announcement that she'll be taking over as CEO. What did she say about stepping into the role after the Sugihara scandal?
Well, she talked a little bit about the type of culture that she wants to cultivate at Warner Brothers. She'll have both the head of the film studio, Toby Emmerich, and the head of the TV studio, Peter Roth, reporting to her. She said she wants a sort of collaborative, respectful environment. It's interesting, too, in talking to people at other companies who have worked with her, they talk a lot about her having a strong backbone. Mm. I spoke to folks at PayPal, where she sits on the board, and people who knew her at Nickelodeon, and she's sort of known as having a strong moral compass among leaders.
If you want to change a company's culture, that strong backbone would come in very, very handy.
Helps.
Yeah. Did she offer any insight on how she plans to do this and maybe eliminate the seemingly toxic culture that was there before?
You know, she didn't get into a lot of specifics. She talked broadly about culture, and she said that she didn't know a lot about Warner Brothers culture, that she's sort of coming in with a fresh start and looking to learn more about the place.
So what can Sarnoff then bring to the table in terms of Warner Brothers' digital plans for the future?
Well, she's worked in a variety of different types of media companies. As I mentioned, Nickelodeon. She was also at Dow Jones, the WNBA. Her most recent gig was at BBC Americas, where she played a role in developing their streaming service called BritBox. That's going to be important at Warner because later this year, Warner Media will launch its own streaming service. And while that part of the company is not under Sarnoff's purview, she'll be involved in looking at Warner's films and TV shows and trying to figure out which one should go to the streaming service and which one should be distributed through more traditional routes.
And speaking of streaming services, we can't not mention Netflix and one of its most streamed comedies. That's the theme song from the American version of The Office, which premiered in 2005. Now, anecdotally, it's one of the most streamed shows on Netflix, but all good things, regrettably, Rebecca, come to an end. Or do they have to? Why do they have to come to an end?
Well, NBC Universal would say, not an end, just come on over and give your money to us rather than Netflix. NBC Universal announced yesterday that it's pulling The Office from Netflix when that deal ends at the start of 21. They're spending $100 million per year for 5 years for the rights to the show because if you're like me, you hear that theme song and you get kind of a good vibes feeling. It's a familiar property that the company hopes will lure users to their new platform.
All right, so NBC getting their own streaming service, Warner Brothers getting their own streaming service, Disney getting their own streaming service. What kind of content will be left for Netflix?
Well, this is really Netflix's biggest dilemma right now, and it's why the company is spending money hand over fist on its original programming. The challenge for Netflix and the advantage for these studios that have been around for 100 years or so is intellectual property. Audiences are drawn to characters and stories they already have a familiarity with, whether it's Star Wars, Wonder Woman, The Office. Netflix doesn't yet have a property like that of its own, and it's a major issue for the company.
We already have a million streaming choices, Rebecca. How will that affect consumers who will be now inundated with more options to stream their choices?
This is really a big question, I think, for the industry right now. I've seen some research that suggests people are willing to sign up for a maximum of 3 streaming services. Mm. So if you figure most people are already on Netflix and probably one other, maybe Hulu, maybe Amazon, Disney, I think, will grab a lot of folks with kids. How much can we sustain? At a certain point, it begins to feel like just having cable, which many of us still pay that bill. So, you know, these bills are getting higher and higher as each new company joins the fray.
Regrettably, Rebecca, because I'm such a superhero nut, I probably will want to have as many streaming services as possible so I don't miss out on anything.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the driver and why it's so important for these companies to have characters and properties that people like you know. Ultimately, what's going to make you decide to plunk your credit card down is you just have to see The Flash wherever he is, and they know that.
All these streaming services are using my desires against me because,
That's right.
I will be forking over the cash. Now, staying with Netflix, let's talk about what it's done for stand-up comedy specials, which brought us gems like this.
I think my husband and I have a huge unspoken understanding between each other because he's half Filipino and half Japanese and I'm half Chinese and half Vietnamese. So we're both half fancy Asian and half jungle Asian. Yeah. You guys know the difference. The fancy Asians are the Chinese, the Japanese. They get to do fancy things like host Olympics. Jungle Asians host diseases. It's different.
That's from Ali Wong's Baby Cobra comedy special on Netflix. That made the ride to Las Vegas from L.A. very, very tolerable because I was laughing throughout the whole thing. Now, before the Netflix resurgence, what was the state of stand-up comedy specials, Rebecca?
Well, stand-up comedy specials were a lot rarer. I mean, there was HBO, Showtime, and Comedy Central were the main venues for people to get a special. And the assumption was that when you got your stand-up special, that was really the pinnacle of your career. That meant you'd made it. What's interesting about what Netflix has done is if you look at somebody like Ali Wong, most people hadn't heard of her until her special became really a phenomenon. And that's the case for many, many comics that Netflix is putting on its platform. They're finding this massive audience.
Well, that's how I found her that one time, because I had already, you know, I still watch Dave Chappelle's specials, Chris Rock's specials, Bill Burr's specials, just because I just want to find some stand-up comedy. But then right in that same zip code was Ali Wong, Baby Cobra, Hard Knock Wife. So I watched those because they were right next to the other comedians that I like. So when it comes to someone like Ali Wong, how is this really transformed her career?
Well, it's interesting. Those some of those comics that you mentioned, the you know, the Chris Rocks, the Dave Chappelle's, those folks were a big part of the story about Netflix and comedy a few years ago when we were hearing these $20 million per special deals. But at the same time, Netflix was making these much smaller deals, more around $500,000 and under, with lesser known comics like Wong. And the impact has been that whereas somebody like Ali Wong was opening for other comics and playing small clubs, she went to selling out major theaters as a headliner, ultimately taping another special, and this year writing and starring in a movie for Netflix, Always Be My Maybe. So the platform grew her career and then sort of provided a venue for the next step in it.
So it feels like, Rebecca, that this is going to be, or it could be, a way where Netflix sets itself apart, considering that the streaming landscape is going to be very saturated very soon.
I mean, in a way, Netflix already has. I mean, one thing they told me when I was reporting the story is that over half of their 150 million subscribers have watched one of their comedy specials. So they've definitely found that for their audience, this is important programming and possibly something that will keep people tuning in as The Office and other properties migrate to the other streaming services.
Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. She joins us every Wednesday to talk about the entertainment biz. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
Puppies, kittens, calves, cubs, piglets. I mean, you really got to have a heart of stone if you don't love baby animals. It's when they're at their maximum level of cuteness. Coming up next, find out what baby critter was spotted in the Santa Monica Mountains for the first time in 30 years. That's ahead when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. The iconic Amoeba Music will soon be moving to a new location. Now, where, we are not exactly sure, but yesterday it did become official. The LA City Council voted to approve zoning changes that would replace the store at the corner of Sunset and Cahuenga with a 26-story complex. So that famous building will eventually be demolished. Jim Henderson is the co-owner of Amoeba Music. He says the City Council decision comes as no surprise to the music store. They sold that building in 2015, but this doesn't mean the end of Amoeba in LA.
We're here. We're not going, we're not closing. We are moving eventually, but we've got at least another year in our lease. There's a little bit of wiggle room there. And once our lease is up, we'll be moving to another spot. We're looking at a couple of exciting prospects in Hollywood, and we expect to kind of land locally and really maintain on a scale similar to what we are currently operating on.
He says customers should rest assured regular scheduled programming will continue for the time being. Amoeba Music opened in Hollywood back in 2001. All right, turning now to the raptors of the sky. For the first time in 30 years, a pair of golden eagle chicks have been found in the Santa Monica Mountains. A consultant conducting bird surveys stumbled upon the 12-week-old male and female chicks several weeks ago, but the National Park Service is just now releasing information about them. Katie Delaney is an ecologist with the Santa Monica Mountains Recreation Area. She's on the line to talk about the birds. Katie, welcome back to Take Two.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
All right, now, in this morning's press release, the National Park Service included pictures of the chicks, and since the audience can't see, can you describe what these golden eagle babies look like? Because, Katie, I just want you to know that those pictures made everyone in the KPCC newsroom and Take Two area just fawn.
Well, they are pretty cute. Most baby birds aren't that cute, but they are quite large, so they were really, really huge. I would say they're between about 8 pounds each of them. They're almost adult size, and an adult golden eagle can stand 2.5 feet tall. And I guess I can say for their temperament, they were amazing. They were really calm, and they were very cooperative, and it was they were pretty cute. We were all quite enamored with them.
You said they're big. Can I assume that means they're well fed and they're healthy?
Yes. The biologist that we were with, who is the raptor expert, said that they were in great condition and very, very healthy.
All right. So clearly very cute, very adorable, but also dangerous. Why haven't we seen golden eagles in the Santa Monica Mountains for 30 years, three decades?
Yeah. Golden eagles are actually very intolerant of people. So in Santa Monica Mountains has gotten more.
Just
and more
like me, Katie. Me too.
I find that hard to believe, but yeah, it's very, they avoid people, and the Santa Monica Mountains has gotten really busy. There's lots of recreation. There's lots of development. So this was a really great discovery to make, that these eagles have sort of found a place, a very remote place in the Santa Monica Mountains to call home. And we're hoping that they'll come back next year and nest.
Talking to Katie Delaney, an ecologist with the Santa Monica Mountains Recreation Area. Do we know why, Katie, they're back after three decades?
No, that's a good question. We don't really know why. We don't know. And the other thing is, it was discovered this year, but it's possible that they have been here for a couple of years, although we have done surveys through the mountains throughout the years and have not found them. It is a pretty remote area, so we could have missed them, but we really don't know why they're back. It is a great news, and it's sort of a good story for protecting these big open parks that our animals can use to avoid people and thrive.
Yeah, the Santa Monica Mountains the last couple of years has had a rough time with fire, and we just did a story a few days ago or last week about frogs that are suffering there. Does the reappearance of these birds of prey mean that the surrounding environment is healthier than it's been, or maybe some positive news coming out of the mountains?
Yeah, for sure, it's a very positive story. I mean, I'm not sure necessarily if it's a big, you know, overall, if it means that the Santa Monica Mountains are the best place for every single animal, but it's a really great feel-good story for protecting open space and protecting these species that need big open parks away from people to thrive.
Now, Katie, it sounds like the chicks are doing a good job staying away from people as much as possible, but is the National Park Service doing something to protect the chicks now that they've reappeared?
Well, we're not telling anyone where they are. we're keeping their location a secret. And that's the best thing that we can do to protect them.
And also, I mean, for everyone out there, please don't go out looking for them, right? I mean, you don't want someone to, like, search for them and trample through things to find them and take a look at them.
No, that's true. And I can say they're very remote. And if you were even to look at, when we go observe them, we on a daily or weekly basis, we have to be very far away. They're very well hidden.
All right, Katie Delaney is an ecologist with the Santa Monica Mountains Recreation Area, a unit of the National Park Service. Katie, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, if you missed any part of the show today, you know what? I probably did some awesome interview that you really should listen to. So please, please, please go to wherever you get your podcast and look for the Take Two podcast. So then you can be whole after you listen to the whole Take Two show. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at Take Two, at Take Two. I'm there too, at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.